Picture this. It's a little after midnight, the 16th of May, 1943. Somewhere over the flooded valleys of western Germany, a four-engine bomber is thundering along at 60 feet. 60 feet. That's not a typo and I didn't misspeak. Lower than the treetops in some spots, low enough that the crew could see cattle scatter in the moonlight. The pilot is holding that airplane rock steady, while the ground blurs past faster than a race car, and up ahead, filling the whole windscreen, is a wall of concrete holding back a lake. Pull up a chair. This one's a good one. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we keep the old stories flying. Today, we're going to talk about one of the most audacious nights in the whole history of military aviation. The night a squadron that didn't exist a few weeks earlier went out to bounce bombs across the water and break the dams of the Ruhr. Before we get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and believe me, the fellas in this story earned a coin they never got to hold. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's set the scene properly. The Ruhr Valley was the beating industrial heart of Germany. Steel, coal factories, the whole war machine ran on it, and that machine ran on water. Water for the steelworks, water for the canals that moved the coal, water for the hydroelectric plants. Behind the Ruhr sat a handful of enormous dams holding back millions of tons of it. Break those dams, the thinking went, and you don't just make a mess, you cripple production, you flood the mines, you knock out the power, and you do it all in one night. Trouble was, nobody could break a dam from the air. Believe me, they'd thought about it. A dam like the Monet was a curved wall of masonry, better than 100 feet thick at the base. You could drop conventional bombs on it all day and just chip the paint. Torpedoes were the obvious answer, but the Germans weren't fools. They'd strung heavy torpedo nets across the reservoirs, hanging down deep into the water. Anything you dropped in the lake would tangle in the nets long before it reached the wall. So the target was, for all practical purposes, impossible, and that's usually right about where an engineer gets an idea he can't let go of. His name was Barnes Wallace. Now here's where it gets interesting. Wallace was an aircraft designer, a brilliant one, the man behind the geodetic airframe of the Wellington bomber. But this damn problem got its hooks in him and wouldn't let go. He sat there and thought about it like a physics problem, which is exactly what it was. The story goes that he found his answer thinking about skipping stones. You know the game. Every kid who ever stood by a pond has done it. Flat rock, low sidearm throw, and if you get it right, that stone skips across the surface 1, 2, 3, 4 times before it finally runs out of steam and sinks. Wallace thought, what if a bomb could do that? If he could make a bomb skip across the surface of the reservoir, it would leap right over those torpedo nets. It would hop across the water and smack into the face of the dam. And then, here's the clever part. If it was sinking right up against the wall when it went off, the water itself would do the work. Water doesn't compress all that force. Instead of blowing out into the open air, would be driven straight into the masonry, like holding a firecracker in your fist instead of your open palm. So he started throwing things. Literally, marbles across a tub of water in his back garden. Then bigger tests, firing spheres from a modified gun down at the naval testing tanks. Watching how they bounced, measuring how spin affected the skip. And that was the second piece of genius. He put backspin on it. Spun the bomb backward at around 500 revolutions a minute before release. The backspin did two things. It stabilized the skip, kept it hopping true across the water. And when the bomb finally hit the dam wall, that spin made it crawl down the face of the concrete, hugging it so it sank right against the wall before it detonated at the perfect depth. Wallace had his weapon, they called it upkeep. It wasn't the sleek-finned bomb you're picturing. It was a big drum, a cylinder, weighed about 9,000 pounds, most of it a torpedo explosive called Torpex. Looked more like a garden roller or a giant depth charge than anything you'd expect to hang under an airplane. But a clever bomb is only half the job, because to make that skip work, the delivery had to be flown to numbers that would make any sane pilot's blood run cold. Here's what the physics demanded. The airplane had to be flying at exactly 60 feet above the water, not 70, not 50, 60. And it had to be doing right around 230 miles an hour, and it had to release the bomb at precisely the right distance from the dam, somewhere around 1,400 feet out. Get any one of those wrong and the whole thing falls apart. Too high, the bomb shatters when it hits the water instead of bouncing. Too fast or too slow, the skip goes wrong. Too close or too far, it either doesn't reach the wall or it bounces clean over the top. and you had to do all of this at night, in a heavy four-engine bomber over enemy territory, with people shooting at you. The airplane for the job was the Avro Lancaster. Now, if you know your warbirds, you love the Lancs. Big, graceful four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines singing that unmistakable song. She was the finest heavy bomber Britain built in the war. And normally she did her work from 15, 18,000 feet up in the dark. Asking her to skim a lake at 60 feet was like asking a draft horse to run the Kentucky Derby. They stripped these Lancasters down and rebuilt them special. Pulled out the mid-upper gun turret. Took out the bomb bay doors entirely, because upkeep was too big to fit inside. Instead, they slung it underneath. Held in a special cradle with two swing arms and fitted a little hydraulic motor, driven by a belt, to spin that drum up before the drop. To fly these missions, they stood up a brand new squadron, 617 Squadron. It didn't even have a number when the crews first arrived. They were told to train for low-level flying and told almost nothing else. Just fly low. Lower, lower than you've ever flown in your life, and do it at night. The man they picked to lead it was a 24-year-old wing commander named Guy Gibson. 24 years old and already flown something like 170 missions. A born leader, hard as nails, and the crews would follow him anywhere. Which, as it turned out, was straight down into the valleys of Germany. Now let's talk about the two problems that nearly sank the whole thing. Because this is where the airmanship comes in, and I love this part. Problem 1. How do you fly at exactly 60 feet at night? Your altimeter is useless that low. The barometric altimeter in the airplane just isn't precise enough to trust your life to at 60 feet over water in the dark. Guess wrong by 20 feet and you fly into the lake. The fix was beautifully simple. Two spotlights. They mounted a lamp in the nose and a lamp back in the belly, and they angled them so the two beams would meet, would form a single figure eight of light on the surface of the water only when the airplane was at exactly 60 feet. The crew's job was to fly until those two spots of light kissed together on the water below and then hold it there. When the pools of light merged into one, you were on altitude. Elegant, no computer, just two light bulbs and a triangle.
Problem 2. How do you release at exactly the right distance from the dam? Now, both of the main dams had towers on top. Two towers each a known distance apart. So somebody, and there's a lovely story that it was worked out with a plywood triangle and two nails, built a little handheld sight, a wooden Y with a peephole and two nails at the tips. The bomb aimer would hold it up to his eye. And when the two nails lined up with the two towers on the dam, the geometry told him he was exactly the right distance out. Let it go now. Two light bulbs and a piece of plywood with nails in it. That's how they solved problems the finest minds said were impossible. Back when the answer to a hard problem was a slide rule and a good idea, not a warehouse full of electronics. So, the night of the raid. 19 bombers split into waves, launched into the dark and flew across the North Sea and into occupied Europe right down on the deck, hedgehopping the whole way to slip under the German radar. And it cost them from the very start. Flying that low in the dark is deadly all by itself before anyone fires a shot. One Lancaster hit the sea and lost its bomb. Others flew into power lines. One clipped high-tension wires and went down. The flak towers along the route caught others. Men were dying before they ever reached the target, just from the sheer violence of flying a heavy bomber at treetop height across a whole country at night. Gibson's wave reached the Moni Dam first. And I want you to really sit in that cockpit for a moment. You come over the hills and there is the reservoir, silver in the moonlight, and there's the great curved wall of the dam. And on top of that wall, the Germans have gun positions, light flak, throwing tracers straight at you. There's no diving in from altitude and pulling off. To deliver this weapon, you have to fly a long, flat, straight run right down the throat of those guns, holding 60 feet, holding 230 miles an hour, dead steady, no jinking, while the tracer comes up to meet you like a garden hose full of fire.
Gibson went first, dropped his upkeep. It bounced three times, they say, hit the wall, sank and blew a great column of water hundreds of feet into the air. And when the spray settled, the dam was still standing. One wasn't enough. So Gibson did something that tells you everything about the man. On the next cruise run, he flew his own airplane alongside them, up the valley, drawing the German gunner's fire onto himself to take the heat off the man making the drop. Flew back into those guns with an empty bomb bay, just to make himself a target, and he did it again, and again. It took five of those bombs, five runs down that valley of fire, and then at last the Moni Dam groaned and a breach opened in the middle of that 100-foot wall, and the whole reservoir came pouring out. One of the crews radioed back, and you can still hear the disbelief in it, that the flood was rolling down the valley and the moonlight was shining on the water racing east. The dam was broken,
So the surviving airplanes with bombs still aboard turned and flew on to the next target, the Eder Dam, tucked down in steep hills that made the approach even more brutal. They had to dive over a castle on a hilltop, drop into the valley, get down to 60 feet, line it all up, and pull up hard over the far side before they hit the mountain. Some crews had to go around 3-4 times just to get the geometry right, and they cracked the Eder too. A third dam, the Sorp, they damaged but couldn't break because it was a different kind of dam, an earthen bank, and the skipping attack just didn't suit it. Now, I'm a pilot, and I won't dress this up for you. The cost was terrible. Of the 19 Lancasters that set out, 8 did not come home. 53 of the young men who flew that night were killed, out of 133 aircrew. More than a third of them gone in a single night. 3 more became prisoners.
And down below, the floods killed well over 1,000 people. And here's a hard truth of that war we shouldn't skip past. A great many of them were forced laborers and prisoners, folks with no say in any of it, drowned in camps in the valley below the Mone. Did it win the war? No single raid does. The Germans, to their credit as engineers, patched the dams back up faster than anyone expected, had the Mone rebuilt within months. The knockout blow that Barnes Wallace dreamed of didn't quite land the way he'd hoped, but here's where it gets interesting, and here's why we still talk about it more than 80 years later. The Germans had to pull tens of thousands of workers off other projects to fix those dams and defend against it happening again. Every reservoir in Germany suddenly needed guns and nets and men. And the story of it, 19 bombers, 60 feet, a bouncing bomb, a plywood site, went around the world and told everybody, on both sides, what these young men and these machines were capable of. It was a shot of pure nerve at a moment the Allies badly needed one. And for us, the pilots, the ones who love the flying itself, it stands as one of the purest examples of airmanship under pressure that I know of. Think about what those crews actually did. Precision flying, to the foot, to the mile an hour, at night at treetop height, into aimed gunfire, holding a straight and level run when every instinct in your body is screaming at you to break away. That is flying of the very highest order, and they did it with light bulbs and nails and their own two hands on the yoke. Guy Gibson got the Victoria Cross for that night. He didn't survive the war. Barnes Wallace lived a long life, went on to design all sorts of remarkable things, and by many accounts carried the weight of those 53 young men with him for the rest of his days. That's the part they don't put in the movies. The engineer who dreams up the impossible weapon still has to read the casualty list in the morning. If you ever get the chance to stand next to an Avro Lancaster, and there are only a couple left flying in the whole world, go and do it. Listen to those four Merlins. And think about a 24-year-old wing commander flying that beautiful machine back and forth through a wall of tracer at 60 feet. So the man beside him would have a clean shot at a dam. For the details of this one, I leaned on the records of the Royal Air Force, the writings on Barnes Wallace and his own account of the bouncing bomb, and the histories kept by the RAF Museum and the folks who preserve 617 Squadron's memory. If you want to go deeper, and this is a story that rewards going deeper, you can find where I keep my notes over at RadioHangar.com. That's the Mone, the Eder, and the Men of Chastise. Fly steady, keep the shiny side up, and I'll see you back here in the hangar.